Good morning. My name is Pamela Bryant, and I'm a health communications specialist with CDC's Immunization Safety Office. And my presentation this morning will touch on the challenges of communicating results of vaccine safety, surveillance, and research, and messaging strategies for communicating on vaccine safety monitoring and adverse events. I will wrap up with the major points discussed in this session for delivering clear, consistent, and timely vaccine safety messages. As you know, CDC manages and co-manages several vaccine safety monitoring systems in place in the United States. There's the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, or VAERS, which is co-managed with FDA. There's the Vaccine Safety Data Link. That's a collaboration with 8 managed care organizations in the United States. There's the Clinical Immunization Safety Assessment Network, or CISA, which is managed jointly with 6 medical research centers. There's also the Real-Time Immunization Monitoring System, or RTIMS, which is a collaboration with Johns Hopkins University, the Emerging Infections Program, or EIP, in which we work with 10 state health departments, and the American Academy of Neurology, or AAN, in which we've worked with them specifically for GBS, as well as working with the EIP for GBS surveillance during H1N1. From a communications perspective, however, the system that poses the most challenges for us is the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. And I just want to take a quick second to say thank you to the VAERS staff, because they are always there for us. I mean, it takes a whole lot to kind of understand what's happening in the system and to interpret the data to the best of our ability. And the staff works really, really hard to help us in our communication efforts. Just quickly, there are some benefits and limitations to VAERS. First of all, I'll discuss the benefits. As you know, VAERS is a national program that's co-managed by CDC and FDA, I just mentioned that, to monitor the safety of all vaccines in the U.S. VAERS accepts reports of adverse events following vaccinations. Some of the benefits include the fact that VAERS is an early warning system for potentially clinically serious vaccine adverse events or health outcomes. So it serves as some signal detection for us. Anyone can file a report to VAERS. VAERS is national in scope. Data is reported from all states and U.S. territories. VAERS helps us to generate hypotheses about adverse events following vaccination. And also, reports from healthcare providers are encouraged. Some of the limitations of VAERS is that it usually cannot assess causality. And VAERS is subject to variable reporting. There's also no unvaccinated comparison group. And then underreporting can sometimes be a limitation as well. People are not either aware of the system or they just don't take the time to report. And lastly, VAERS has variable quality of data. Reports can vary in quality and completeness, and they often lack details and sometimes can have information that contains errors. So all of those limitations have to be taken into consideration. This is a screenshot of the homepage for VAERS, and here you can learn more about the system, how it works, you can report a vaccine reaction, and you can also search the VAERS data for reported adverse events. This is the page that will take you into the data system, which is called CDC Wonder. Data from VAERS is captured and made available to the public through CDC Wonder. The Wonder online database uses an ad hoc query system for the analysis of public health data. This means that anyone can visit the Wonder site, enter their search criteria, and get information from the database of VAERS reports. Data can be downloaded, raw data can be downloaded either by complete file, by vaccine, or by symptom. And you should know that Wonder was designed to promote information-driven decision-making by placing timely, useful facts in the hands of public health practitioners and researchers, and to provide the general public with access to specific information from CDC. The data in Wonder is updated monthly. However, it was increased to weekly updates during H1N1. And we wanted to do this to reflect the most up-to-date information for our users. Some of the challenges of communicating results on vaccine safety are listed here in this slide. And I want you to know that VAERS is a passive reporting system, meaning that reports about adverse events are not automatically collected, but they actually require a report to be filed. So one communication challenge while discussing vaccine safety is to create an awareness for VAERS and telling what the system can and cannot do, such as the previous slide where I explained the benefits and the limitations. We've found that extra time spent with a reporter, a researcher, and even a parent helps to eliminate confusion and inaccuracies in interpreting VAERS data. It also gives us the opportunity to explain how beneficial the system can be in monitoring vaccine safety in spite of its limitations. And as mentioned, there are multiple sources of information available everywhere and in various formats. Our challenges include keeping abreast of what vaccine opponents are saying about a vaccine safety and skillfully communicating the science-based evidence we know in support of vaccine safety. And to do this, additional challenges come into play in working with our subject matter experts, both at CDC and FDA, to ensure our communications are easy to understand by the general public. And lastly, as always, our messages and material are developed in communication activities are coordinated among all agencies who share a role in vaccine safety responsibilities, from ingredients to manufacturing and production to clinical trials and testing and vaccine administration. Now, there are some special challenges when communicating about VAERS, such as self-identification, articulating rare events reported to VAERS, communicating limitations on causality, and the misinterpretation of VAERS data. And just quickly, I'll point out the fact that self-identification has been one of the major challenges with people in VAERS. Because the data is reported publicly without commentary of what it means, it poses this challenge. Reports of rare events could be in the media before they are recorded properly in Wonder. And so we actually have to work very closely with SMEs to put those adverse events into context and explain what we know. Here's a list of some of the broader issues that we deal with in communicating on vaccine safety surveillance. And I just wanted to point out that we do have twin goals of conducting thorough scientific assessments of the risk data and communicating vaccine safety information in a timely manner. So again, we're in constant contact and constant communication with our subject matter experts to understand the data and then communicate efficiently and effectively. Also, the first available data in VAERS has several limitations. Again, reports can lack completeness and accuracy. And it's never possible to prove a zero risk. So some of our messaging strategies for VAERS include employing the principles of risk communication when necessary. And during H1N1, we found that to always be necessary. So we've done this through coordination and collaboration with our federal partners and other credible sources for consistent messaging and accepting and involving the public as a legitimate partner. And most importantly, using plain language as much as possible in our messaging. We've also found that the use of background rates help to put adverse events into context. And one example of this that we've used during H1N1 is in the US, about 80 to 160 cases of GBS are expected to occur each week, regardless of vaccination. So that kind of lets the public know that we don't see any increased reporting of GBS that's above the norm. And this shows some of our communications resources. This is a sample of our VAERS fact sheet that's available online. We also have brochures and print ads and web buttons and other material on our website to help healthcare practitioners communicate about the system. So in summary, these are a few of the major points from this session I would like to leave with you. Vaccine safety monitoring is complex, and licensed vaccines undergo rigorous safety testing before they are released and are continuously monitored for safety and efficacy. Also, vaccine safety communication is based on the best available science. And lastly, our coordinated activities and consistency in communication among federal, state, local, and other partners is definitely necessary. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We have about 5 minutes if there's any questions or comments. And actually, I'd love for people to go to the microphone. If you could make your way to the microphone, would be ideal. Great. Go ahead.
Hi there. I've got a two-part question. And one is, we've been talking a lot about the challenges of communicating a very complicated and complex vaccine development and monitoring and safety system. And I would like the panel's perspective, because both Stephanie and Pam touched on this, of sort of over-reliance on communications as a means to make the public feel safe and increase actual vaccination rates. And second part of the question is, how can local and state and county health departments rely on partnerships with local community groups in order to help get those messages out?
Stephanie?
Okay, thanks. That's a good question. Can you hear me? Is this on? You know, I touched upon this a little bit, that vaccine decision making is complicated, and there are various factors that come into play. Communications can help address some of those factors. So, for example, the proliferation of information on the internet, some of it is not credible. So we can counter some of that information, and perhaps then someone will make a decision to vaccinate based on sort of that credible information. But alternative health beliefs, you know, people who just feel that taking supplements or organic food will boost the immune system, that may not change. That's a fundamental belief someone holds. So I think there are limitations. I think it is our due diligence to do the most that we can around vaccination, but communications can, I think, go only so far. And I think it would be not wise for us to feel that communications can solve all of these issues around vaccine hesitancy, some of the gaps in coverage among minority groups. It's an important tool, but it is only one tool in the toolbox. For partnerships, maybe I'll let Pam or Tanya talk about that.
I'd just like to mention that we have established a communication partnership or regular communication with vaccine safety coordinators, and there are about 62 vaccine safety coordinators nationwide that we speak with regularly, and this is how we get information out to our local and state health departments. So one thing that we can do and continue to do is encourage them to reach out to maybe to grassroots organizations and others, so that our messages can get, you know, much deeper into the communities. Does that answer your question?
Great, next question.
Hi, I have two of them. We seem to have lost our national disease memory, which has changed our risk-benefit conversations with our providers and our patients. Yeah. Has our nation considered the use of national immunization public service announcements to remind them about the disease risk, such as Canada does those? Second question, recent anti and alternate vaccine movements have spun off to some providers using vaccines off-label and not under IRBs. This includes not adhering to minimal intervals and appropriate doses. How is this growing issue being addressed in the post-licensure surveillance, and the impact of the public health being managed?
Great, two great questions. Do you want to, Stephanie, are you able to take the first part maybe?
Sure. The way I will address your question, we've done some focus groups that talk about the value of vaccines, and you're right, a lot of younger moms and sort of generations today have no memory of these diseases. So they feel that because they've never heard of them, what's the point in vaccinating them? But we found in messages when you talk about, and I think the measles epidemics that have popped up, that serves as a reminder. When we talk to people that these diseases are continuing threat, those messages resonate. So what we found in some recent focus groups that people talk recently heard about the risk of vaccination, but not the value. So I do think we need to sort of shift a little bit more in talking about the value of vaccines, how these diseases are sometimes a plane right away, disease can reemerge. So I think that's a good point.
Maybe Lori can handle the second question.
Briefly, yes. I'm not quite sure I understood it completely, but I think if you're talking about using vaccines off schedule, for example, or something like that,
alternate doses.
That's a tough one. The FDA policy is that once a product is approved and labeled for its intended approved use, a physician may, as a part of the practice of medicine, prescribe that product as he or she deems appropriate. So in government speak, what that means is it's up to the physician to determine. You know, the recommendations are to use it a certain way. It's labeled to be used a certain way. So it's a very difficult thing to enforce. We don't have the authority to stop them from doing it. Now, having said that, we obviously do look very closely and in post-marketing surveillance to see if there are any flags, if you will, or signals that would lead us to believe that something might not be used properly. And obviously, if we saw something along those lines, we would communicate that, you know, quickly and clearly to the public.
Great questions. Next question.
Hi, I'm Carolyn Cook from Tacoma, Washington. And one of the issues we had, that I had around safety information that was being given to people, is that there was a difference between our ACIP recommendations and package inserts for the vaccines. And this has come up more than once. And just in the interest of communicating clearly, is there anything that you can do to coordinate those two things? Or I understand why there's a little bit of difference, but it was a big problem, especially concerning the use of live attenuated influenza vaccine for H1N1.
Lori, do you want to tackle the issue of package inserts?
Are you talking about, for example, pregnancy and use
of
the vaccine?
Yes, and breastfeeding.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The agency's view is that...
Pregnancy was clear. Don't give LAIV to pregnant women. But breastfeeding wasn't a big issue. It was an issue.
Was it? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That one I'm not as familiar with. Pregnancy, I can answer.
Pregnancy was clear.
I'm not sure I have an answer for that.
I think that that's a really good point, though, yeah. And probably something that we could take back as mm-hmm. a group and really look into how we can, you know, better. I understand the package inserts obviously have, you know, are guided by regulatory issues. Mm-hmm. So yeah. How we can better kind of make sure that they're consistent with what other recommendations are coming out from the department. I think that's a very good point.
Thank you. And I just have another kind of comment, not question, but I use, the MMWR published a list of adjuvants used in vaccines, and I find that very helpful in the interest of transparency when I have parents who have concerns about adjuvants. And I'd like to request that perhaps you could publish something that was a little more friendly to parents that talks about why exactly those adjuvants are used and the benefits of those, and looks, and just something that's short and also talks about potential, you know, the risks of those adjuvants. So that takes a lot of time once I hand that paper to people to explain why aluminum is in there, why antibiotics were used, how much of this product is left. Or so if there was something that was written, I appreciate that MMWR publication, but if there was something that could help explain it to parents, great. I would appreciate it.
Great points.
Hi, I'm Tammy Pilisuk from the California Department of Public Health Immunization Branch. And I spend a lot of time on the internet and monitoring the popular media looking at the anti-vaccine movement and what the issues are in that community. And as I think most of us have surmised, there's a great amount of distrust of the government and also the perceived collusion between government and big pharma. And I'm particularly interested in response from the FDA, because I would like a really nice response to be able to say that, you know, there really isn't any collusion, that the FDA is an independent organization. Are there any rules or regulations where you have, you know, you don't let big pharma people go to the FDA? I don't have those answers, so the questions just kind of hang there.
It's an excellent question, and certainly an issue that we all deal with as far as distrust of government. From the standpoint of FDA, there are very specific rules that apply to FDA employees. We may not own stock in any FDA-regulated industry, which means 20 cents out of every dollar you spend is spent on something that we regulate. Even if I don't work in the Center for Food Safety, I cannot own stock in food products. I can't own stock in any medical device manufacturers, et cetera. So the rules are very specific. When it comes to the decision making of the agency, I think that, you know, one of the things that we've tried to stress a lot recently, and I think you will see in a lot of our messaging, is that our decisions are based in science, and that is it. And so I think that is a key, thing that, feedback from you that I hear that we need to do a better job of, and I'll certainly take that back and appreciate the comment.
Thank you. And then I had one more question for Tanya. We often put in our materials and communications that giving multiple vaccines, all of the antigens are just, a drop in the bucket compared to, what a child would normally pick up playing. But I hadn't heard the comment before, if I understood it correctly from what you said, that that this could actually boost the immune system. And I wondered if you had a backup scientific document we could go to for that.
Yes, we do, and I can get that for you if you can talk to me after the session.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Lisa Kritz from Chicago. Now that the people who have got, the pregnant women who have got the H1N1 have had their babies, is there a study, have we studied the babies? And if so, could you put something out on that? Because pregnant women is such a big issue.
That's a really great question. So I believe, and I don't know who's the best to comment on this, but I know that we're kind of working collaboratively on the VAMPS study. Do you want to mention it?
Well, just quickly, I know NIH had a number of clinical trials that were going on safety in pregnant women, and we could certainly follow up with our colleagues there to see if they have any additional information.
I mean, especially now that the babies are born.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think that's a very good point, and I think also we've started working on a surveillance system, particularly for pregnant women, that includes both vaccines and medications. And so I think as information comes out of that system as well, we'll be able to better articulate the safety of vaccinating pregnant women as well.
Thanks.
The baby's protective level from her being vaccinated while she was pregnant, that's the, one of the biggest things that we try to convey to the mother, is that the reason why we want to vaccinate you while you're pregnant is so your baby has some conferred immunity when it's born, because you can't vaccinate them for 6 months.
Right. Let me just say that for folks in the back of the room who wasn't able to hear the individual in the front, who basically said that, can we better articulate the immune response and antibodies in the baby, so the protective immunity from the baby as well. Great comments. Next question or comment?
Yeah. Since a lot of parents have been focusing on autism due to vaccination, now that the guy from England had withdrew his research on MMR, right, is there anybody researching on other causes like the environment that can also cause autism? Is there anybody somewhere?
Yeah, so CDC's National Center of Birth Defects and Developmental Disability actually handles autism issues, and so they do an extensive amount of research that's funded not only from CDC, but also NIH is doing quite a bit of work as well. So, even though it's something that we as communicators try to not bring up, it's the constant question. And obviously, this past year there was the Gallup, I think it was a Gallup poll, but just recently an AP report saying a survey of parents on their thoughts of whether vaccines actually cause autism, and it was quite high. So it is something that, unfortunately, despite the retraction, is something we're probably going to have to deal with long term.
Yeah, but the thing is, they only focus on vaccines. If they are doing some research on, like, the environment can also cause this, I don't at least hear anything in the media saying that.
Yeah.
They are doing something about it to prove
right.
that.
So this fall, actually, CDC, actually AAP and in pediatrics, and also CDC released autism numbers. And within those press conferences and with all of those stakeholder calls, we were very happy to say that there was not a single question on vaccines. And so none of the media in any of those reports when those new autism numbers came out had any sort of reference to vaccines. So that's good news.
And Abigail, I just wanted to add, if you go to CDC's website, you can look for a study called the SEED study. And that is specifically looking at the causes of autism. and environmental factors are a component of that research.
Right. I think we have one more question at the microphone.
Hi. Given that a lot of concerns that parents have are related to vaccines that are combined, like MMR,
right.
What's being done to look at why there's increased febrile seizures in kids that get MMRV as opposed to MMR? Are they studying that?
There's about 18 months of work, actually, and I don't know if you can comment anymore on that, but it's published in MMWR.
Right. This.
I'll get the date from you.
Okay. And great, and actually somebody is correcting me up front that there will be a talk on that topic this afternoon. Just a quick reminder, there is continuing education for this session, and if you stop by the CE room in the Learning Center, you can get your continuing education. At 12:30 in Regency Ballroom 6, there's an immunization Q&A session, and the next session starts at 2:00. Thank you.